Hello, welcome to the Life You Can Save podcast. Today we'll be talking about a neglected women's health and human rights issue that remains a huge problem in many low-income countries around the world, despite it being highly treatable and preventable. We're talking about obstetric fistula, a condition that you may not have heard of, the reason being that it's extremely rare in high-income developed countries. Not only is it a traumatic and painful condition that women experience during childbirth, it can also lead to women being stigmatized and outcast from their community. And we're very lucky to have Kate Grant, CEO of the Fistula Foundation, on the podcast with us today to help us understand the issues around obstetric fistula and what her organization is doing to address this devastating condition that affects many women and their families around the world. Kate, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Kate, it's been quite a journey for you, I imagine, since founding, or no, becoming the first CEO of Fistula Foundation in 2005. Can you share a little bit about your experiences prior to working there?
Sure. When I got out of university, I actually worked in the private sector for two big advertising agencies in the United States. And in my 20s, I went on a trip, took an extended trip with a friend, and spent a lot of time in the developing world, in Northern Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia. And I would say I never quite came back from that trip. I mean, I physically came back, went back to my advertising career, but it never made very much sense to me after not just seeing, but sort of living in situations where resources are so constrained. And after some soul searching, I decided to go back to graduate school and actually studied international development at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, and then went into a career, basically international development and aid to poor countries. So I worked in the U.S. government. I worked on Capitol Hill in a political job, but focused on foreign aid. Worked for the Rockefeller Foundation, and then ended up through a series of events I don't need to go into just because it would be boring, ended up at Fistula Foundation in 2005. And was the first CEO. And at that point, we had we're supporting one hospital, one country that was treating fistula. And now we're treating thousands of women in over 20 countries. So we've grown dramatically, which is satisfying. But that's my background in a nutshell.
Well, it sounds like it's been a kind of amazing growth journey since 2005, going from the one hospital in Ethiopia, as you say. And you've picked up a lot of awards along the way too. You've led the foundation to excellence with 13 consecutive four-star ratings from Charity Navigator. And this places you in the top 1% of nonprofit organizations evaluated. So these must be some really satisfying figures as you kind of reflect on your work so far.
It is. What's satisfying about those awards is that I think they give our donors confidence in giving us money that will actually get done what we say we're going to get done. The problem with doing work that's largely focused in some of the world's poorest countries is most of our donors that are in Europe and the United States are not going to travel to, say, Democratic Republic of Congo or Pakistan to see their work. So they have to trust us to get done what we say we're going to get done with their money. So those outside awards and accolades, particularly from watchdogs, are meaningful, not so much from an ego standpoint, but from a practicality standpoint, that they give people confidence that we're getting the job done for them. And I think, frankly, when people give you money, you owe it to them to get the job done. We have sort of an implicit mantra around here, which is it's not our money. People give us money to get women treated, and we're very focused on that.
Yeah, and I think we'll come back to that about being an effective organization and how you've come to be known to the Life You Can Save. But just for everyone listening, I thought it'd be good to start with defining what the condition obstetric fistula is and why solving it is important.
Great. Well, obstetric fistula is a childbirth injury. It happens to women who stay in labor too long, who have what's called an obstructed labor. In the United States or in the UK or in any basically developed country that has emergency obstetric care, that labor is relieved with a cesarean section, a C-section. So for instance, I had a C-section when I had my son after 24 hours of labor in New York. Other than a bruised ego, I was fine. I ended up with a healthy baby. I was healthy after the surgery. And that's true of the, you know, millions of women that get C-sections a year. But for a woman that's delivering in a modest home in a rural area in a developing country who doesn't have access to the C-section, what she'll do is she'll stay in labor for up to a week. And so the injury basically happens during that obstructed labor where women get, and there's not a nice way to put this, they get holes in their vagina and their bladder, and those holes are what create incontinence. That's the thing that makes this issue so tough, because I don't care whether you're in Dubai or Dallas, nobody wants to talk about incontinence. Sometimes also it could be fecal incontinence with a hole in a rectum. So that's the bad news. A young woman often on a first birth gets this horrible injury that not just leaves her incontinent, that as you were mentioning in the opening, also stigmatizes her. And too often she becomes an outcast and rejected by her own family and community. Bad news, that's a really tough topic. Okay, that we're over with that part. The good news is, at the hands of a trained surgeon, 80 to 90% of the time, that injury is treatable. A woman will go in for a single surgery that can last less than an hour and go from, again, an incontinent to often and also physically and emotionally rejected person to a cured, healthy woman. And that's extraordinary. So that's what we focus on. We focus on getting that woman that's had this horrible injury into an operating room with a trained surgeon and getting her problem solved.
And I'd really like to come on to some of those stories about the women you've worked with in the past few years. But first, I just wanted to ask about the topic itself. I guess one of the things that Lauren and I were conscious of when we were preparing the podcast is the issue itself and the kind of complexity around it, the unknown for many people in the West, and I guess a sort of discomfort as a male talking about this anyway. So how do you address all that and spread the message of what you do?
Well, I guess what I do is first try to acknowledge that it is a tough issue. It's a vaginal injury. You cannot talk about fistula in any degree of specificity and not be able to say the word vagina without blushing or becoming uncomfortable. But the thing is that if you can get beyond the anatomy of it, again, where there's taboos in developed and developing countries around female anatomy that way, and you realize this is just a young woman who was trying to bring a child into the world. Most of the time, here's the bad news, more often than not, 90% of the time, the baby dies. So she's lost a baby after going through a full-term pregnancy, and that's a horrendous loss, and then has this injury. And if we can just focus on that woman and her loss, and what she needs is surgery. So to take people out of the taboo and bring them to their heart and have them see in this young woman, their sister, their mother, their aunt, their friend, their wife, whatever it takes. She's just like us. The only difference is between her and me is I gave birth to my son in New York and had access to emergency obstetric care. There's the difference. And she deserves our compassion, and she deserves us getting over our lack of comfort with female anatomy and incontinence. So I try to just let people know it's okay to feel uncomfortable about this a little bit, but let's get over that. Let's get to this woman who we care about.
Focusing on the narrative and the empowerment that can come through treating this very preventable condition, I can see how that's much more easier to communicate and can get people to engage with the issue some more.
It is one of the things that we do, and we've done it from the beginning because it just seems so commonsensical, really, is to tell stories of the individual women. Now, no two stories are exactly alike, but there's obviously some commonalities amongst them. And to give these stories, to give these women, not all the thousands we treat, we don't have thousands of stories we share, it would overwhelm our donors, but to give our donors a perspective on the kinds of change they're enabling in women's lives, we give real stories of real women. We often change the name for confidentiality to protect that patient's privacy, but the details of the story are sincere and real. And I find that does an awful lot to open up people's hearts. There but for the grace of God or goddesses or something go I. It could be me. It could have been my sister, my mother, had I been born someplace that didn't have the resources we all take for granted.
Is there particular sets of story or one story in particular that sticks out to you, or are there just so many it's difficult to choose?
Well, there's a multitude almost. I can think of one from a decade ago, and I can think of one from the last time I was in Kenya last year. And I'll tell you the more recent one in Kenya. This was a woman who was in her late 50s, Mwatene, I believe was her name. And she lived in rural Kenya. And we actually went out to visit her at her house, and she'd already had the surgery. But the thing that was astounding to me was she had had this injury for 34 years. Mm. 34 years. And the amazing thing was her husband, this isn't the norm, but her husband actually had stuck with her. And through the translator, it was so interesting. He sat with her the whole time and talked about what a great beauty she was when they were younger and basically how much he loved her. But he had stuck with her that whole time. And the thing that was astounding was she was not out in, say, the highlands of northern Ethiopia, where you don't really see much of anything, these hilltop villages. She was on a dirt road, but we drove out to it. She wasn't that far from a paved road, maybe a couple miles, and she wasn't that far from a hospital. And still, she'd had this injury. They'd gone and tried to get treatment from quacks and medicines that hadn't worked, and she eventually was cured. And when I went to see her, it was actually a little uncomfortable initially. Went into her home, and she kept standing up to hug me and to try to like dance with me. And she was so excited because I think I'd been introduced to her. There was a language barrier, so we had a translator as the person that had done this for her. And that made me feel very uncomfortable. Like, I just work here, you know, like give this joy to your, you know, the surgeon. But a minute or two into it, I thought, you know, I'm being rude, actually. She wants to share her joy with me, and I need to let go of my own sort of inhibitions and just take her gratitude and enjoy her joy. And as we're getting ready to leave, we walk outside, and there's nothing there. They'd sold off part of their land to pay for these quack treatments, and there's just this little, like, sort of pile of things I think they'd taken out of the hut just so that there was space for me to sit. And there were these three lone chickens. That was it. They're skinny chickens. And she gets up and gives me one of the chickens. And again, my practical self is saying, I don't need your chicken. Like, what am I going to do with your chicken? And you really clearly need it. And of course, the voice inside my head from back in the hut was like, no, I need to take the chicken. And somebody that actually works with me there that runs our program, a wonderful, insightful Kenyan woman named Habiba, so it was like, you need to take the chicken. So of course I took the chicken, and we ended up giving it away to another, actually a fistula survivor we met later in the day. So the chicken did not go to waste. But that story was astounding to me because she had had this injury so long. And yet even at a time in her life where maybe others might've given up on her, we certainly didn't give up on her, but she and her husband didn't give up on herself. There was this joy-filled woman. So I could tell you other stories. I don't think you want to spend the whole podcast hearing them, but it's extraordinary. This program we've had in Kenya, just as a footnote, over the last 5 years, Kenya is a reasonably developed African country. It's in the bottom tier of middle income countries by the UN definition, with high, middle, and low income. So it's really not one of the poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa. But in the 5 years, we've really dug deep. There, the average number of years a woman waited between injury and treatment, again, in a relatively developed African country, was 9 years. Think about that for a second, 9 years. If you develop that injury here, you were saying at the beginning, it's rare in the United States or the UK, that's certainly true. Occasionally it does happen. In fact, I met somebody at a conference who's happened to his wife, but guess what? She was treated for the injury before she left the hospital having delivered the baby. She didn't suffer for 9 years. She didn't suffer for 9 days, maybe 9 hours, you know. Anyway, very different situation we have.
I was glad to hear that you managed to find someone to give the chicken to, because I imagine the U.S. Border Control would have been tricky to get food.
It kept sort of squawking in the back of the car. We'd sort of forget it was there, and then it would squawk. And it was great. We gave it to somebody who was very happy with it. And apparently, as a side note, chicken, like in the U.S., sort of jokes about, you know, chicken dinners. But in that part of Kenya, chicken is what you serve for a special occasion. Like if your daughter's getting married and you're welcoming the new son-in-law into the family, a chicken is a special thing. But I remember her joy, and it lives with me.
In terms of the programs you run overall, how do you kind of think about the different elements of solving the problem, and how does that then correlate into the programs you run?
Well, I'd say that the cornerstone of our strategy is we work closely with African and Asian doctors and hospitals. And so what we try to do is to not be prescriptive about telling those folks that know their environment better than we ever will exactly how to run their program. So we have an overall strategy, which is to get the most women we can treated in a high quality manner in the most facilities possible, in terms of actually how that's implemented on the ground, we listen more than talk. And we're humbled to the fact that somebody that's running a hospital in Kenya knows more about that environment and what it takes to be successful there than we ever will. So we try not to have too many top-down solutions and then to be flexible about how we provide support depending on what's needed on a local basis to ensure women need surgeries. And again, the core of what we do, the vast majority of our dollars go directly into surgical costs, but depending on what's needed, we'll pay for outreach activities. We might pay for a vehicle if women need to be transported. We might pay for an operating room to be refurbished if they've got more demand than they have a physical plant to conduct the surgeries in. The core of it is surgery, but again, we try to be flexible and humble to the knowledge that exists on the ground.
And is there any program or channel about identifying women who may have a septic fistula who aren't necessarily telling that to the health authorities?
Exactly. One of the things that has been most important, again, I'll go back to the example of Kenya, just because we have done a focused, robust effort there over the last 5 years, is one of the things that's driven surgery numbers to, frankly, twice what our original predictions were very robust outreach activities, working with a variety of groups, including men's groups. We have a program in Kenya called Let's Kick Fistula Out of Kenya. We sponsor a women's soccer team. We've sponsored these mime performances that get into the local communities. We work with, again, women's groups primarily, but others to get the word out, because the condition is stigmatized and because too often a woman has encountered obstacles, like the woman I was mentioning in Kenya who gave me the chicken, who'd gone to facilities and been told you're not treatable or a treatment that was quackery didn't work. So it's important that we continue to get out and let women know, no, you're not cursed. This is a most of the time a treatable condition. And that's an important part of what we do.
Is that the most important thing in terms of the messaging that you send out to say we have a different, well, there's a surgical solution that you may not have encountered so far, or is right. It kind of the stigma that makes women uncomfortable to go, or just logistical problems?
Well, you know, it's complicated, sort of all of the above. In other words, there are women that will have gone to a facility and told they're not treatable, and maybe it just was that there wasn't a surgeon there that had been trained, but they take the message that they're not treatable, as opposed to they're just not treatable at that facility. You have women who are not empowered in their family or community to have even the resources to get to a hospital, because transportation is expensive if you're desperately poor. Even a bus ticket might be out of the range of resources you have. And so you have to rely on somebody else to approve you doing that. So it's complicated. I guess the other thing with Kenya, we have a network of hospitals, 5 hospitals throughout the country. And it's that network of hospitals which also, I think, increases awareness for the program. So you don't have a woman going to a hospital and being told, sorry, the surgeon was here last month, but there's nobody here now, or just there's nobody here, period. We have surgeons at those facilities that work 12 months out of the year.
And touching on what you kind of mentioned earlier, why do you think specifically the Fistula Foundation is viewed as such an effective charity by the Life You Can Save and other organizations?
I think because on the one hand, we're very focused on just on fistula treatment. We don't even work, for instance, on fistula prevention, which would involve promotion of C-sections. Not that that's not a worthwhile endeavor for somebody. It's just bigger than our scale. If there's over 1 billion people in Africa and half of those women give birth at home, the idea of being able to provide emergency obstetric care to that quantity of human beings, as valuable as that is beyond us. We sort of stay in our own lane and we do one thing, which is surgery. We can put together basically a graph that would have our revenue on it, go in an upward slant, obviously, a 45-degree angle, roughly. The same, there's a parallel between that and the number of surgeries we fund. I mean, we're very accountable. You give us more money and we'll demonstrate that we get surgeries done. And I think in terms of accountability to the Life You Can Save and some of the other watchdogs, it's the ability to not just have pretty pictures on a website and great heart-tug stories, but to also demonstrate that you can scale what you do and do what you say. And not just with nice words, but with metrics. At least in the case of United States donors, a lot of them don't do research before they give to a charity. And that means they can be suckered by somebody who just has nice stories, but is actually spending most of the money on the organization and not getting it out to the field where it changes lives. That doesn't mean somebody's behaving fraudulently, like they're out buying Ferraris with the money. It just means they're not very focused and effective, or they've got too big an operation in the United States or in the UK. Like I say all the time, nobody gets cured in our office in Silicon Valley. We keep this operation small because, like I said, there's nobody getting cured here. I mean, it's enabling cures, but we always have to be very clear that's not happening here. We need most of our money to get in the hands of providers in Africa and Asia.
And in terms of the donors themselves, do you find, or since you've started working at the foundation in 2005, have you found that donors have started asking different types of questions as there comes a sort of more data-driven approach towards charity?
Yes. I think particularly with I would say the Life You Can Save donors, but with potentially younger donors who are more used to doing research on a variety of things before they make purchase decisions, online reviews and the like. And I think we're gaining donors, and we get it in comments on our website, and sometimes people when they call in or even, you know, send a check through the mail, that they are looking at our financials, they're looking at our results, and they like giving to us because they have confidence in the money doing what we say it'll do. So my hope is that over time, over the next 5, 10, however many years, that it becomes normative for people to do research. And what that does is it drives out inefficient organizations. Because what bugs me is when you've got organizations, and not just fiscal organizations, are all over the place, that are doing quote unquote good work, but they're not doing it effectively or efficiently. And that's a opportunity cost that's large and sort of unmeasured. And in the, if you think about it for a second, in the for-profit world or even in government, you've got things to police inefficiency, not perfectly, but over time you do. And, you know, in government work, you've got a ballot box in a democracy that tends to get rid of people that aren't doing what they say they're going to do. And in the market, you've got competitors that sort of the invisible hand that, again, works imperfectly, but sort of pushes out inefficient entities. The same's not true as much as I'd like it to be in the nonprofit sphere. And that's why I love Life You Can Save and the work being done by Peter Singer and Charlie Russell and their team, because I think it's pushing the sector where it needs to go. At the end of the day, we all are going to be better at solving some of society's toughest problems by being smarter about it.
I agree. And I think particularly when you have a problem like fistula, that we know how to solve it. It's just a matter of having the right medical professionals around the world and getting the message out. I mean, I don't know what the latest figures are. Are there around a million women that suffer from this around the world? Is that
yes.
Around right still?
Yes. That's the best data we have in sort of peer-reviewed and therefore accepted format is a million women, which is a lot, obviously.
It's a lot, but it's a number that can be, or like a problem that can be solved. And I think that's what will excite donors, whether they're from the Life You Can Save or from other philanthropic organizations that are looking at the data.
That's true. And I think for our individual donors, it's that they might not be able to sort of change the whole world, but they can change one woman's world. They can, you know, make a difference. And I think that's gratifying, as it should be. You know, that said, we want that curve, that upward sloping curve of number of surgeries to keep going up so that we get treatment to those million women.
Just to add one more point on that, I think sometimes the effective giving movement in general gets misunderstood about lacking empathy, but arguably the most empathetic, compassionate thing you can do is give someone the best possible chance to improve their health or education or whatever the question is.
Yeah. It's so interesting you say that. I agree that I think sometimes effective altruists get sort of tarred with, you know, all you care about is the numbers. But I think that's wholly unfair, because the idea of looking at numbers and looking at effectiveness is so you can help the most people. It's an incredibly empathetic act to just give without thinking. That feels more like it's about the donor feeling good about themselves. And that's okay. That's not a bad place to start. But pushing ourselves to feel good about what we're doing, but to be as tough-minded as we can about doing the most we can on the margin, I think is important.
And so just moving on slightly, we read that you had a very high-profile partner, and I'm going to mispronounce this, so I apologize in advance, Dr. Dennis Mukwege.
You are really, really close. I say Denny, but that's because it's French. And people around here, when I was saying Denny, I think they thought I was just on like a pally name with Amina, D-E-N-N-Y, but it's actually how Dennis would be pronounced in French. But Mukwege is exactly right. You got it.
I'll take that. And so we've seen he's won the Nobel Peace Prize.
He did.
Could you talk to us some more about your partnership with him and what exactly he does in the area?
Sure. He's actually our longest term partner with our global mission in spring 2009, actually February 2009, so almost 10 years to the month, was when I first met him. And he had been running Panzi Hospital for about a decade at that point. He founded it. It's in Bukavu, which is in the northeast corner of Congo, and an epicenter, I would say, of security and healing for women that have been brutalized in this conflict, where too often rape has been used as a tool of war. So he's built this oasis, and the women there get treated for fistula, but they also get treated for HIV/AIDS. They can have safe childbirth deliveries if they're there, you know, when they're delivering. So it's more than just a fistula hospital. But since 2009, we funded his fistula work. And how that happened was he had lost a major funder with the crash of the financial markets in the fall of 2008. So when I met him, a fortuitous time in terms of our partnership, he really needed our support. And so that's where that began. And he is though the real deal. When I heard he won, and he'd been nominated a few times, he deserves it. He's a courageous man and has spoken out in a variety of settings, including the UN, about the problems, the horrific problems in Congo. I have just deepest respect for him. He's put his own life on the line to get women treated. And he's also an extraordinarily humble human being, which is too rare, but particularly around somebody with as many virtues as he has.
Well, fantastic. But in addition to the Congo, you work in a number of other countries where conflicts have been ongoing. Is that right? Like Afghanistan, Sudan, Somalia, Somaliland.
We do. And that's somewhat deliberate. And as we were talking a bit ago, fistula really happens when women don't have access to emergency obstetric care. And they're more likely not to have that in places that are extremely poor, or even in areas where there's conflict, because they're not able to get to a clinic or hospital if they have problems in labor. So it's not that we target conflict zones, but in some ways it makes intuitive sense that we'd end up funding in those areas and partnering those areas, because those are the kind of places where women in labor and need time-sensitive treatment obviously often don't get it. So yeah, Somaliland, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Democratic Republic of Congo. We've also had long-term partners in Niger and Chad, which there's not hot conflicts, but there's definitely a lot of violence. And also in northern Nigeria, where you've got problems with Boko Haram. So yeah, we work in some tough neighborhoods. Our partners work in those tough neighborhoods.
Yeah, I can imagine that being extremely challenging. So what sort of approaches do you take in the conflict zone, where there are obviously lots of other things going on?
The way we work there really falls out of that same strategy, basic strategy we talked about at the beginning, toward the beginning, was we listen hard and try to help those partners with what they say they need, rather than us sort of, you know, at all trying to tell them how to work in a war zone. We listen to what they need, and where possible, we try to support that with funding. So where angels would fear to tread in some places that are, again, very tough to work in, usually the folks that are working there are indigenous. Again, they're people that have grown up in Somaliland. I think about Edna Dawn, who's one of our longest-term partners. Actually, we began funding her in the fall of 2009, who runs a hospital that she built herself over the course of a decade in Somaliland. And so she's She was actually the first lady of Somalia in the 1960s and retired and was a trained midwife and built her own hospital. And she does there more at that hospital, does more than fistula. But I visited her there and she actually lives in the hospital. So when I was there for a week, I actually lived in the hospital too, in a almost felt like grad student housing on the top floor. But yeah, so that's it. That there's not, the trick is finding really good people and then being humble servants to what it is they need.
Fistula is obviously prevalent in those contexts that are typically male dominated and women don't always have full control over their bodies or their households. So yeah. How do you engage with men in these communities to improve the access and the empowerment of women?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about fistula is we don't run into generally problems overall with men because we're not trying to change a societal norm. We're trying to fix somebody's wife or sister or daughter. And so when possible, when there are men's groups that we can engage with, just to talk to them about the injury, to help them understand it, because they might not understand it. Just the result of an obstructed labor, there's nothing else to it than that. And most of the time it can be fixed, and let them reach out to their fellow men to explain this and create awareness amongst men. So we actually haven't had an issue. We're not trying to change a societal norm, really. We're just trying to get attention to an issue. And again, most of that communication, again, back to tying our work as closely as we can to the grassroots, is that we're not out there. I'm not doing a session in Kenya about fistula. A Kenyan is doing a session in fistula about, or in Kenya about fistula, if that makes sense. So again, working with existing groups, and it's a stigmatized issue. The treatment itself isn't a problem. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And just kind of looking forward, Kate, into this year and to the next couple of years, I guess, what goals do you have going forward? What are you aiming for?
Well, as I said earlier, we're going to be pushing very hard this year in the foreseeable future, to continue to open up as many hearts, minds, and wallets, so we can fund more surgeries. And part of this is I literally have on the corner of my desk a long list of hospitals that are going to stop getting funding because the U.S. government is their contract with this program. They've had 2 5-year contracts, and the second one of these comes to an end this year. And we don't take government money, so it wasn't a contract with us, but it was with another organization. And so I know that there aren't big funding streams coming into fistula. And so that motivates me to think about how we get more support. The good news, though, I'm being bullish about it, is unlike where we were 10 years ago, which is we had a plan, but we had a small organization and we didn't have a track record. Now we've got a track record. So it isn't just, trust me, I'm well-meaning and reasonably well-educated and I think I know how to do this. It's, we've got a track record and we can get this done. And there's so much more to do. So that's kind of it. Where we have more resources, we're going to drill down the way we did in Kenya and the way we did in Zambia. We're looking at another country in Asia doing this, where we can create a network of hospitals within a country, because we think that's the way to really eradicate it in a given country. But it takes more money, basically, because there are more facilities. You need to do work to kind of make sure those facilities communicate well together. So there's work on the ground that happens that costs money. But I'm excited about where we're going, because again, we've got a track record. We're not just saying, trust us. We're saying, you know, here's where we're going to put more money. We can do this. And if you're part of it, you can help a woman get her life back. That's huge. These women are usually in their 20s when they're injured, and you can create a productive life for somebody for 40, 50 years or longer. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's a great gift. And so for listeners who are thinking about making a donation, what kind of price point makes a difference?
Right now, our surgeries, the average across all sites is $586. It's a real number. You can tell it's not one of those rounded up numbers. That said, we actually, it probably is going to move up slightly. We usually look at it every year or so and make sure that it's accurate. So for roughly $600 US, you can pay for a surgery. And so that's the price point we have, and it obviously we have a number of people that give us, our average donation is under $100. So most of our donors don't even pay for a single surgery, but together they pay for a lot of surgeries. So that's it. We've had people do some really terrific, like small scale fundraising efforts. Like, you know, a woman, for instance, had a dinner and invited 20 people and basically said, you know, let's not go to dinner. Everybody, you know, chip in $25, $30, whatever it was, and we can pay for a surgery. That's a kind of meaningful donation. And also an event like that can help open minds to fistula, because as we talked about at the beginning, fistula was very prevalent in places like the US and the UK up until a little over, 120, 30 years ago. There used to be a fistula hospital on the site in Manhattan where the current Waldorf Astoria Hotel sits, on the Upper East Side, one of the richest areas in the country, if not the world. And where that hotel sits, there used to be a fistula hospital and closed in the 1890s because the injury used to exist here. But the problem with it is, the problem with creating awareness is, thankfully it has been eradicated, largely eradicated here and in other developed countries, so people don't even know it exists. But these small scale fundraising efforts can help open up hearts and minds, and then sometimes the wallets follow, which enables us to get women treated.
Well, Kate, we think it's fantastic what you do. And yeah, I encourage anyone who's listening today to, yeah, think about $586. I guess that's $50 a month if you're going to do it on a sort of recurring monthly basis. And this time next year, I guess you make a life-changing difference.
I love that. I hadn't thought about it exactly that way. But yeah, if you know, your New Year's resolution, you're going to help one woman this year. Put it on your monthly credit card. You might not even feel it.
Well, and hopefully, anyway, having had you go through some of the details about how you run your operations, being very bottom-up, grassroots, engaging with local communities, listening to them, that really is the future of how charity is going to work in these sort of contexts, low-income countries, and in terms of sustainability. So yeah, it's fantastic to hear about what you're doing. And we'll promote this as widely as possible to get people engaged.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time. I do personally, having worked in international development for 20 plus years, 25, whatever, coming up on 30. I do think this is the way forward. That even when I was in graduate school in the early 90s, before there was the internet, it cost $10 a minute to call Africa. There, and even faxes were expensive because you had to send them across phone lines. And so these big sort of top heavy infrastructures at US government, some of the big charities, made sense. But it doesn't make sense anymore when you can communicate directly, readily, freely, easily with partners all over the world. And you've got some very capable, dedicated people in developing countries that can, what they need usually is just support.
Absolutely. So, Kate, for people to find you, how should they get in touch? Do you want to just give some details of your website and other details?
Yeah, if you know the word fistula, you should be able to find us. And fistula is just like fist, F-I-S-T, and then U-L-A. So we're Fistula Foundation, and you stick that into any search engine, we should pop up. There's a handful of fistula organizations, so if you're at all confused, we're the only one in San Jose, California. So think sort of Silicon Valley. I mean, we're not like an expensive, like, but we're in that nice cheap building. But anyway, we do try to use the tools of technology to make what we do efficient. So in that way, I guess we fit our Silicon Valley roots. But so Fistula, Silicon Valley, like www.fistulafoundation.org, you found the whole thing. But if you just put Fistula in, you should find us.
Excellent. Well, I think that's all we've got time for. So okay, just finally to thank you once again for coming on. It's been fascinating to talk with you, and no technical hitches as far as we're aware, despite talking to you several thousand miles away. So yeah, thanks again.
Well, thank you so much for your interest in this and for listening to me hammer on about it. But I'm so grateful for the exposure you're giving us, and also just grateful to the Life You Can Save movement more broadly, because I think you're bringing in a change of kind of norms and expectations for a whole sector. And that kind of change doesn't happen overnight. So good for you for your doggedness, because I think over time, getting a sector to behave in a way that's more effective and efficient and responsible will improve lives, save lives.
Okay, Kate, thanks very much. And for the listeners, thank you again for listening, and speak to you soon.